This is The Conversation. It's episode 135 with Max Maslansky, Los Angeles-based painter, sociologist of porn, particularly of the antiquated variety, and art world sage, among other things. Also radio host on K-Chung. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can see images of Max paintings and a shot of him and his dog Belvedere as well, if the paintings alone aren't enough enticement for you. We are joined by my beloved occasional co-host Deb Cloudman, and that means it's going to be a barn-burning episode. Great to have her back. It's infrequent. I don't hear that much from you guys, but I can tell you from my own experience that when she's around, it's a better episode. And I tend to occasionally get hyperbolic about how good an episode is. I know I've done it a couple of times, maybe not more than that, and maybe that's okay. But this is one of the best episodes ever of this show. So I'm excited to share it with you. Max hosts a show on K-Chung Radio based out of Los Angeles. And I have a show, my show, this show, runs on K-Chung once a month. But in any case, all that to say that Max knows from what he is speaking, and you will hear that. And getting back to Deb, yeah, I'm glad to have her back. And, you know, if you guys clamor a bit more, maybe we can get her around here more frequently. The last episode, 134, was with Fishers Island-based artist and residency director of Lighthouse Works on Fishers Island, Jacques-Louis Vidal. That was another great episode, and I highly encourage you, even if you have not heard of him, as I had not before we got in touch, to enjoy that episode as well. Before we finally get to this episode with Max, I do want to thank all of you for being here and for listening. I am grateful to have you, and I am grateful for the support that I am getting and have been getting. I also want to brace you for the new frontier that we are entering, more or less, and that is the bonus segments of the Conversation podcast. That is, this here episode with Max has a bonus segment that, and here's the controversial part, I will be sharing with supporters of the show. So if you have supported the show with $10 or more, I have you on a list, and that list is going to be launched right on the head or tails of this particular episode, and with it, you will be getting access to the bonus conversation we did with Max, so another half hour in addition to the hour that you are about to hear, and it is equally great stuff, if not greater. He talks about his initial experience showing in a gallery and how traumatic that was. And he talks more about the experience of being an artist showing and what he has learned from it and so on. And there is a lot of wisdom there. So wanted to just give you a heads up about that and encourage you to donate, which I will tell you more about on the back end. For now, let's get to that episode with Max and Deb Cloudman. Thank you again so much for being here, and I'll talk to you on the back end. Well, Max, you know, we've been talking about the show that you've been doing. Have you talked to only artists, or have you talked to non-artists or and art-related people?
I've talked to mostly artists, but I've also talked to curators. I've talked to a few musicians.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked to a commercial photographer at one point, but mostly artists. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty organic. I don't have a mandate. But I prefer to talk to people that are practicing whatever they're doing right now in this fair city.
So the commercial photographer is a friend of yours, for example?
A family friend. But he had, you know, that particular person had roots with the Warhol scene in the 60s. Of course, he couldn't remember any of it.
Wow.
That was
I couldn't remember any of it, so I couldn't really get much out of him there. But, you know, he had an interesting take on life. So, but I don't think I would have had someone, like, just because I thought he was a family friend more because I thought maybe they had just something to say, you know.
Right.
A practicing creative person with something to say.
You know, you've already used practicing. You haven't used practice, which is to your credit, but you've already used practicing twice. I don't necessarily want to go there if we don't have to, because I'm planning on going there with a writer in the near future.
Sure.
But if you use it again, we're going to have to go there.
Okay.
What have been the most memorable moments doing the show for you?
Memorable?
Disastrous or otherwise, or great?
I can't say there's anything that like really sticks out, because you're living in the moment so hardcore that I'm not fetishizing anything that's happening. At the beginning of the show, I thought of it as a comedy show, actually. So I was trying to make improvised jokes work, but I quickly found that I neither had either the talent or the kind of wherewithal to like keep that going on almost a weekly basis.
Yeah.
So it just became more about the interview and staying present with people.
Right.
So there's no, like I said, there's no moment I can really point to, but I can say that there have been, you know, and I'm sure you've found this too, there's certain interviews that resonate with you in your mind longer after the interview's over than others.
Mm-hmm.
And it may not just necessarily because, you know, the person's work is more interesting to you or, you know, the mood you were in, but rather like maybe some issues that got brought up that sort of keep you thinking.
Okay. And so now we go from the general to the specific.
Okay. Well, one was one episode that I really am still very fond of is I met with Jake Longstreth, who's a painter. I don't know if either of you are aware.
I think I've seen some of his work.
He does sort of landscapes and representational work, but we just got on this long, almost the whole episode was dedicated to the Eagles. He was a big Eagles fan.
Oh, wow.
And I am a sort of a anti-Eagles. And it also brought
so
issues about mediocrity.
Yeah.
You know, what is mediocrity? Is it good? Is it bad? Is there a point to it? My Jake was arguing that, you know, their mediocrity is actually their best asset in a weird way. So anyway, I just, long after, you can start thinking about what it is that an artist does that can resonate with the largest amount of people over a long period of time. And you cannot deny the Eagles have figured out a way to do that.
I love that.
Yeah.
I think that one phrase that their mediocrity may be their greatest talent might make me reexamine them like a little bit.
Yeah.
Just like,
and
just
I did too.
Touch. Yeah.
And I did too. And that was kind of, I think, what stuck with me. Like I left the interview with maybe a shade or two, you know, of a stronger sort of understanding of why that band still manages to persist, you know?
And when you're doing these shows, they're live on K-Chan, correct?
Yeah. So it's a little scary.
Do you listen to any of them afterwards?
You know, I used to.
Because they don't get cut, obviously.
Yeah,
there's
I don't
no
edit them. I used to religiously. I'm getting more sick of hearing my own voice, so I don't do it as much.
Yeah. Did you go through a period where you, at the beginning, heard yourself and you're like kind of cringing, and then you kind of got used to it and comfortable, and now you're kind of going back in the other direction? Is that kind of what's
probably going on? I think that's a fair sort of description.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because if I get to a point where I, you know, where I'm where you are now, I'm in trouble.
Right.
I don't have an editor other than myself. So.
Right. Yeah.
But maybe that will actually be a moment of phenomenal expansion in which suddenly you have an editor. And,
oh, right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Just when I get to the point where I can't stand
that's
my voice
be the
anymore.
Moment.
Right.
It's
exactly.
Be the
yeah. Exactly. Because as you know, everything happens for a reason. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Have we been hearing that a little too much lately?
Yeah.
Just a touch.
Just
a tiny touch.
Yeah. God.
Totally.
I think a recent guest said that, so hopefully they're not listening right now. And if you are, sorry. We can talk about it when we meet. Well, this idea actually of being in the moment is really interesting to me, because I'll confess, and you can confess if you have anything to confess afterwards, but in both trying to be in the moment and anticipating future moments, as in where we're going to go,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's really hard to be in the moment. So I find that I get exhausted because I'm like, you know, trying to listen to what somebody's saying and also trying to think, oh man, this is not going well. You know, I want this to be over soon.
Yeah.
In the worst case.
Yeah, I know what you mean. There is that that moment of terror when you're anticipating the end of a person's anecdote or story, and you know that you have no idea what to ask them next, because either A, like maybe you've been slightly distracted enough not to catch the complete thread of what they're saying, or you're just completely stumped as to how to take this to another place. But your mind has an amazing ability to figure it out, and you do say something. And luckily, at least up to this point, I've never asked like an utterly ridiculous question that made no sense.
Right, yeah. Right.
I love that you went into it in terms of comedy, though. What made you kind of want that? Was that something that you felt like everybody needed?
I needed it mostly.
Yeah.
I mean, I think like a lot of people, you just use it as some kind of, audio heroin, you know, for your daily travails. And some of my favorite things in the world are sort of like comedy-based things. So it made sense for me to like try to, you know, duplicate that for myself with my friends. So it was just like a good entry point. Like I always wanted to have a radio show. So when I found out that Keg Chung was starting, I hunted Saul Bothwell down on social media.
Tell like, people, because I don't even know who Saul Bothwell is.
Oh, Solomon Bothwell is one of the founders of Keg Chung. To my understanding, I could be getting this wrong. He basically just wanted to see if he could get a terrestrial radio station up and moving. And he figured it out because he's kind of got an aptitude for that kind of thing. So once I found out he had done that on Keg Chung Road, I found him on Facebook, and I was like, how do I get a show? Just give it to me.
And it worked.
And it worked, yeah. So, I mean, I started out on the sub list. I worked my way up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I paid my dues, as it were.
And do you have, is there any metrics for your listenership?
I have no idea who listens, where, how, other than what people tell me in person. Like, so if anyone actually says anything to me like, oh, I heard your show with so-and-so and I really liked it, that's gold to me.
Right.
But I have no idea as far as volume or...
Right,
I have
right,
no
right.
idea. I guess, like, if I was really nerdy about it, I could find out, but I have a feeling I'll always be disappointed.
And is there anything archived, or is it all just kind of live and then gone?
It's all archived. It's on the website, though it's not easy to find because the website's not as user-friendly as it could be.
Right. I looked, but I did not look super extensive.
Yeah, exactly. So, see, it's like for more of a casual sort of sleuther, it would be kind of difficult. But I have a Facebook page that centralizes all of the links to the show there. So I usually just send people there because it seems to be the easiest thing.
Right. You know? Right. Yeah.
But yeah. I mean, I'm just glad it just sits there somewhere. So, you know, Mr. or Mrs. Young Artist, who's 4 or 5 right now, can, you know, listen to hear what Jake Longstreth said about the Eagles 20 years from now or whatever, you know.
As one of my favorite, fantastic. As one of my favorite podcast hosts often says, listening in their blanket fort.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
exactly.
Well, I guess we should start. Maybe we should talk to the other part of Max. Well, first of all, we should I think talk a little bit about your name, if only for a moment.
Sure.
Is that kind of like, that's like kind of a quintessential Russian,
yes,
name, right?
Russian Jewish. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It actually means buttermilk or butter maker, literally.
Wow.
There was a Polish young lady that I went to college with that in Polish means buttermilk, but I'm sure in Russian it means something else slightly different. But
right.
Yeah, that's what it is.
And it wasn't changed.
No, not at all. They all came here the early 20th century.
Man.
Yeah.
Mine were changed. So
yeah,
Klauden was like actually Kolodenko.
Oh, I like.
Right. It's nice, right? And then the second part of my name, Man, was changed as a stage name because my husband's father changed it from Solomon. So now both of my names are actually just total bastardizations of what they originally were.
Is Klauden, though, originally Jewish, too?
Yeah, but it was Kolodenko. Right. It was, yeah, they changed.
Isn't Kolodenko, though, a both Jewish and Gentile name?
I think so. It was specifically Ukrainian. So
yeah, Belarusian over here.
Yeah, good, nice.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go get some pierogies and I'll be right back and we can.
Mm, I love pierogies.
I know. Who doesn't love pierogies? Sorry, yeah. I went on a whole.
You're getting a little New York thing here.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Well, we've all lived in New York at some point, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I guess if we're going to get down to the nitty gritty, the place that for me it seems the most obvious to start is where this whole, I don't know if fascination is the right word, but interest in this porn subculture, for lack of a better description.
Well, it came out because I was around 2010. I was unemployed, and
between what and what?
Unemployed between being a freelance print designer and my career as a painter. I had a gallery, but you know that. Sort of ended, so I was in between that, and I was just trying to figure out where the work was going to go next. So I just started collecting pictures, and I started putting them in these photo albums on Facebook, and I just did them for myself. And
wait a second,
not porn pictures.
No. That's not the question. The question is, I hope you see where I'm going with Steph.
Okay.
That you are collecting pictures for yourself, but you are storing them on Facebook. That just seems a little convenient.
Well, what ended up happening was there was like the public collection, and then there was a private collection, as we say, you know. And
for premium subscribers.
Yeah. And I started to realize, like, wow, I have a lot more of these porn pictures than I actually have of, you know, say, an image of, you know, some weird dude in the background between some young Christian girls, you know. Like, what do you call them? Photo bombs? Like, it's called photo bomb pictures.
Right, right.
They don't seem that funny anymore to me just because I think they're so pervasive now, yeah, as far as like meme culture or whatever.
Yeah.
But anyway, I had a whole computer full of this stuff, and I thought, okay, how am I going to make art with this? And I had some bed sheets sitting around. I mean, I'm making it sound a little bit more streamlined of a decision than it actually was, but it was just sort of gradual, intuitive material decisions, matching that with the content that was already there. Like, why not paint pornography on a bed sheet? It just made perfect sense.
Right.
If anything, I thought it'd be a bit too obvious.
Right. But
because I had a better aptitude with painting on unconventional supports, it just stuck. And then over time, my technique developed, as anyone does, I guess, when you keep doing it over and over again. And the pictures didn't seem actually, after a while, even as important to sort of be loyal to as far as every detail and everything. I could switch it around. But the greater, I guess, answer to your question is why porn is that it's everywhere. It's just everyone uses it. No one really talks about it that much because it's kind of a vulgar thing to talk about.
Right.
And that was always exciting to me. I always like kind of working against something that might be tasteless or work against something that might offend somebody.
Right.
And I know the art world's seen plenty of nudity and racy things, but I don't know. There's still some kind of slight taboo to it.
But you were coming to it, though, from a sociological kind of perspective rather than, you know, these were your relatives or, you know.
At least I don't know yet. There are some relatives in there. Yeah, I was. I mean, I was trying to figure out for myself what it was about. What's the function of porn? What's the social sort of need that porn is fulfilling for people? I couldn't really answer those questions intellectually, so I could only really do it through making the work.
Right.
And yeah, and I still don't really quite know. I can't say. I do know this. I don't think porn is inherently evil. I don't think it is. Though I do think that it, like any kind of drug or tool, it is rampantly abused. I think that's where the humor of my work comes in.
My sense is that the sources that you're using of porn are of the more now, anyway, from, you know, 2016 perspective, tasteful, you know, quaint version of porn as opposed to maybe the more recent over-the-top version of porn.
Yeah, I would agree. I like vintage porn because there's some kind of playfulness and innocence about it. I don't know whether that's purely my own projection or that's actually nascent in the image itself. I can't really say, but I do know that, you know, anyone who looks at contemporary porn is a lot more violent than I think it used to be. There's a lot more.
Well, it's so much harder to get a reaction now than it used to be. And I think part of the maybe inherent, what was the word that you just used? I don't know if it was naivety.
Nascent.
No, that not naivete, but something else you said, not an inherent innocence maybe said to it. I think some of it was you didn't have to go as far. And now you look back, it's easy to look back at it and think, oh, that's kind of sweet. You know, that's kind of, it feels more like this roadmap to a slightly more excessive intimacy than maybe you have access to in your life, or maybe you haven't had intimacy yet and you're like a 14-year-old boy, or maybe it's, you know, it felt like it was about introducing people to something that was just a little bit more, it was just a little more enhanced. And now, everything is so fast and such easy access that it's a different.
Well, yeah, because I don't know whether I'm getting this through a study or through just general conversations I've had with people, but the dopamine levels that one receives through watching porn have been gradually over the years elevating, right?
Right.
So it would only make sense for them to create more eye-popping, intense scenarios for people to keep the dopamine levels up. That's why production is so rampant, like, nobody ever, like, I don't know, I certainly never did, like, no one ever, like, rewatched the same porn, only that one, over and over again. Like, everyone always has to move on quickly to the next thing. So, there's something, like, really, like, dark and alienating about the contemporary porn that I can't bring myself to paint because I don't even know how to get around the violent misogynistic aspects of it. And I'm sure that, you know, the irony is that in the 70s and 80s, I think there was a lot of horrible things happening behind the scenes too. But I guess just, you know, like, I don't know, the old adage, time heals all wounds. Or what's the word? Like, you know, rose-colored glasses looking back through time. Like, maybe that's some kind of element that... Well, that falls in there. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think the more public, I think the kind of porn that we have access to now from that time was definitely tamer and less, at least less overtly misogynistic.
Yeah.
It's funny. I noticed that right behind you, there's a book on my desk that's hardcore. What does it say? Power, pleasure, and the frenzy of the visible, which is actually all about sort of theories of porn. I think it was written in the 90s. So it's kind of a feminist look at what happens with porn when it's acted out, when misogyny is acted out in an extreme way and it becomes visible, whether or not that can be in some ways productive to look at or not. So,
yeah. That reminds me, there was a, I'm terrible with names and I'm terrible with titles that I've of books that I've read in the past sometimes, but there's this guy that did a memoir of him taking part in the porn industry. He was actually a Cal Arts student. He's about my age.
I think I heard about that book.
Yeah. It was floating around and I think he did a talk at Human Resources at one point. But he ended up going into porn hoping to change the paradigm.
Right.
He was hoping to make artfully made, beautiful, Lee crafted porn films, but ended up just actually becoming a status quo member and churn out schlock to get by. And he ended up actually gearing towards misogynistic behavior towards a girlfriend he had at the time.
Wow.
That's really interesting.
And this is like sort of his memoir of of actually becoming victimized by the very thing that he was hoping to change.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Well, it's that thing of, you know, language matters, visual language or verbal language, the words that we say. You know, it does translate, in my opinion anyways, it definitely does translate into action. And so there's definitely, you know, within the feminist community, there's definitely a big divide between people who are, you know, pro-sex work, pro-porn in certain ways, and people who are automatically against it because of the way that it objectifies women. And it's so complicated. I think for that reason, that it's very difficult to go into a system that's that entrenched and
absolutely
actually change it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, you were mentioned earlier, the conversations that you've been having, you know, that you have when you talk to people about the work. And so the question for me becomes, how many of the questions are, you know, like we're just having, sociological versus personal?
You know, people have, like, I remember one guy came up to me and he was a southerner. So he was like, "Hey man, you must be, you're either a real freak or you're real repressed." and I said, "Yeah, I'm probably more on the repressed side." So on the personal, end, I don't have like a whole lot of, anything to divulge other than, yeah, of course I've used porn. But I ended up like feeling like, why is this such a, you know, like, why engage with this all the time? Like, before porn came along, I think we all were fine. Like, I'm just old enough to remember what it was like to have to seek out porn before the internet. Like, you actually had to seek out the tape and with your friends and, like, you know, figure out how to get around your parents from seeing you have it and all that. And that, all that's completely changed now. Like, you know, you can be seven and watch porn. So
what is your origin story with discovering the magazines?
As somebody with an 8-year old that just had like an internal, like, that.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't
continue.
It's very difficult to stop, kids from interacting with it at this point. I guess the only thing you could really say to them is like, you know, just, you're going to probably see it anyway, but there's, you know, this is nothing to do with real life.
Right.
You know? So, you know, like back then when I was that younger age, no one even had that conversation with me, at least for me. Like, no one ever made that distinction. So, but of course I had my own experiences, my own life, first person experience learning along the way, which is sort of an advantage, I guess, in comparison to someone else who is going to see all this stuff before actually having any of this in their life, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, the conversations do kind of flip between just material concerns, what a painting is, what it's doing, and so on, and why am I so steadfastly sticking to this subject for the past several years, like, you know, which is sociological in nature, of course, you know.
That seems like a studio visit kind of question, you know, like how long can you milk this, you know, porn thing? But really, I mean, with the obvious exception of this Southerner who was very upfront with you, I personally, and I would imagine other people have said, you know, okay, Max, what exactly is your connection to this world, other than the fact that you're like taking a bit of a sociological angle on it, you know what I mean? Like, where is the Max in this, you know, whole scenario?
Well, I think I couldn't really tell you the exact psychological motivations because, you know, and honestly, if I knew what they were, I don't know if I'd want to do it.
Right.
I don't know if I want to make that work. Like, I'm learning about how I even feel about it as I do it.
Right, right.
Like, I've found that the longer that I
good catch.
Thank you. The longer I kind of start with these images, the more kind of critical I get about the culture that brings them about.
Right.
And the more kind of interested I am in trying to make the perception of that culture and the perception of how these images are used with people for a greater good, whatever that is, you know. Like, my worst fear is like my work contributing to sort of rape culture, misogynistic culture, or any of those things. Like, that's one of my biggest fears, I think, at this point.
Well, that's the great thing about the high contemporary art world, is that there's nowhere, you know, it only filters up. It doesn't filter down, right?
Right.
So nobody's going to know. You don't, right? I mean, that's one of the advantages of being in the museum art culture as opposed to the popular art culture, you
right.
know, is that you're not, you know, twisting people's minds if you don't want to, ultimately.
Well, you know, I think you can be preaching to a choir, but I always feel like there's always somebody that you're going to change some way, and even if they don't know it at the time.
I wasn't implying, I don't hope you weren't thinking I was suggesting you were preaching to a choir.
Oh, well, I mean, it's okay if you were.
I wasn't.
Okay. even if you were, it's okay. I think that's it's a very common thing to think.
Right. No, I mean, what I was doing was, just to clarify, is you were saying, I do think about whether this stuff will affect people and how it will affect them, essentially, right?
Mm-hmm.
What I was trying to say in response is that the people who are viewing, who are consuming your work, if that's, you know, not an inappropriate word,
mm-hmm.
have all the tools in their toolbox to deal with it. Except for, you know, with a few exceptions, maybe the Southern, I don't know. But you know what I mean?
Oh gosh, but you never know. You never know what somebody's internal landscape is with something like porn or something, you know, what people are
right.
supposed to think needs to remain hidden, you know. So often it's actually the people, I think, who consider themselves to have the greatest toolbox in analytics,
right.
who are sometimes somewhat stunted on the emotional understanding of themselves and what might attract them to a particular kind of visual pleasure mm-hmm. or experience of pleasure. So I think you're right. But I think on the other hand,
mm-hmm.
There's a chance that, you know, in talking to people who consider themselves to be so, I don't know, beyond maybe being affected by things that are inherently misogynistic, or I think there's actually a chance to.
I think that's a great point. I'm really glad you opened that up, you know, that possibility. And I think, thinking about some of the work that I've seen, that there is definitely a creepy element in some cases, you know, which you probably mm-hmm. control to a greater or lesser degree in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
I think the challenge is the context.
Right.
You know, if we're seeing your work made in LA at the Hammer Museum, you know, we're mm-hmm. seeing it in the context not only of all this other work, but we're also seeing it in the context of the event. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So it's like all these other things. But if we were to see your work, I don't know, maybe in a really small gallery or in your potentially in your studio, if you had it set up in a certain way, I don't know, that kind of situation. I'm not sure what the situation is, but with the fewer distractions,
mm-hmm.
you know, then the kind of thing that Deb is talking about, certain people, maybe many of us, would be affected in a way that we're not even aware of.
Yeah. I mean, I'm amazed anyone has taken any effect whatsoever, because people look at generally paintings or any piece of number 2 or 3 seconds at a time.
Right.
So, you know, yep. if you're taking something, I'm amazed. But my biggest observation, I think, is that, you know, most people take one look and they go, I can't live with that. Can't live with that. You know,
and those are not necessarily all collectors you're talking about, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's like I've seen friends who are, you know, not necessarily a collector, but they're like, that makes me really uncomfortable. I can't even handle, you know, I couldn't even handle why you would make, not they would say that to me so literally, but that's the kind of message I'm getting. Like, why are you making that?
Wow. It never ceases to amaze me, the lack of open-mindedness that continues, you know.
Yeah,
but it's, you know, I mean, I'm like that too with certain things. I'm just like, sometimes I say to myself, "Why'd you make that?" To the artist who's imaginarily standing next to me.
Right.
I'm like, why'd you do that? No, you know. I think we all have like kind of filters of what we want to see and don't want to see. We fetishize certain aesthetics more than others. We're snobby towards certain kinds of groups of people, you know, less so than others. You know, it's like it goes on and on. And
yeah.
Sex is like one of the great lightning rod sort of, I guess, things that sort of really divides people in a lot of ways.
No, I think the big takeaway actually from that comment that you made is about I would never own that. I mean, that's really where we are right now. You know, we're so swimming in the market. You know, whether we like it or not,
you can
say, no, I don't care about, I don't read about the market. I don't care about the market. Well, actually, let me just take that back for a second, because the last guest I had put out is this guy, Thomas McKelly, who is a New York artist and writes for Hyperallergic. And he doesn't engage in social media at all. He commutes from New Jersey. He goes and sees shows and writes about them and edits them. So he might be somebody close to that kind of model who just sees the work. Mm-hmm. You know, and doesn't get bogged down in all the hype and all the new art news, you know, market news and whatnot. But most of us are swimming in that kind of thing. And so as much as I say, I can't believe your friends are saying that, you know, part of me is probably saying, yeah, in some cases, maybe not with your work, but somebody else's work, I might say, you know, I might say more, I wouldn't live with this than I would, wow, this is kind of creepy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I think that people think a lot in terms of acquisitions, which is a strange thing.
Which is good for you, right?
Yeah, you know. dot, dot, dot.
Elysees, right,
Elysees,
right.
LA music collectors, uh-huh. High out there, buy more art. But yeah.
But the sort of like criteria for what one is willing to live with definitely changes depending on the validity of the artist's career and so on. Like you take someone like... Mr. Blank over here, the father of the girl, the father of the young lady from the show Girls.
The news guy, Brian Williams.
No.
Carol Dunham.
Carol Dunham. Thank you. Okay, he's one of my favorite painters, by the way. And I can't remember.
His name. Now you're going to trash him. So go.
No. I mean, I love his new body of work. His new bodies of work. And they're pretty. They're pretty aggressive in a lot of ways, if you have seen them.
The definitely. Perfect mixture of aggressive and market friendly, aren't they?
But I feel like if he was just some 24-year-old dude,
that's a great point.
You know, making these in the studio, I he'd probably get a lot more people going, I can't live with that. You know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I could be wrong, but that's the sensation.
No, that's a totally fair point. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the same thing you were talking about different kinds of snobbery and ways that we like to. You know, we think in schema. It's something we do as animals to make our lives easier, because if we already have pre-existing categories that we've built over time, then just like selective perception when we're looking at a room that allows us to filter in on each other's faces and focus, you know, it makes us easier for us to navigate our daily lives if we have pre-existing ideas about things and categories. So everybody, I think, is built to look for validation. And one of the things that I love about the act of looking at art is that if you let yourself, it actually challenges all of that, you know? But that kind of brings me to my question. When you are working with this particular kind of material that already, you know, pushes buttons for people, do you feel like there's an act of purposeful transformation that's taking place when you are going from this material into a painting? Or do you come at it from a, you know, I'm going to paint this and just sort of see what happens?
I think it's the latter, because I can't, if I come into a painting or a body of work with too specific a mandate, I will make a very stiff body of work.
And
it'll become overdetermined, and because there is a part of me that can get very control freaky, and I've worked a long time to, you know, taming it. So I think as long as I treat it as a material exploration of some sort that is going to lead me where it's going to lead me, I'm basically following the work.
Right.
I let the work lead me, because I, like I said earlier, I have no idea how I exactly feel about it. other than sort of an innate fascination, obviously through filtered through, you know, years of experience and, you know, conflicts about it and things like that.
Which is what keeps it interesting.
Yeah. And like, and of course, like, you know, the longer I've been entrenched in the art world, you know, there are issues like with the market that, you know, like I'm almost forced to consider like that everything overlay like how uncompromising my fetishes can be, you know.
Well, you know, it's funny as you were saying that, I was thinking my question was more than the imagery is using a bed sheet, you know, pushing potential, you know, market targets away.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's like the it's interesting. 'Cause like, I always found that, the trashier the thing was, the more attractive it was to me. Not only as an art object, but like as something to work on. Like, I mean, like Mike Kelly's stuffed animal pieces are sort of like, you know, a game changer for me when I was like growing up learning about contemporary art. Like, oh, this thing that was worth 2 cents is now, you know, all of a sudden through the magic of capitalism, worth 50,000 or whatever it was at the time.
Right.
So you know, that is kind of a joy, you know. But yeah, at the end of the, like, I was getting stuff like, is it archival or whatever?
Right.
But, you know, I've seen a lot weirder things being moved. So that didn't work too much.
Yeah. Well, what about, though, speaking of being moved, what about your transition, if for lack of a better word, from when you were put in Made in L.A.? And why don't you just talk about the whole arc of it, you know, how you got...
How
the studio visit went and, you know, and all in the excitement and however you want to put it. I don't want to put words in your mouth.
I have to say, I think it felt, at least to me, it felt somewhat accidental because, I work at a gallery part time now, but at the time I was working there full time, and, Michael Ned Holte would come in sometimes. So I had a rapport with him and,
he's so lovely.
Yeah. He's a nice guy. So we'd chat sometimes, and I don't know, what I said exactly that perked his interest, but I just was being friendly and I said, hey, you should come over. And he was just like, okay. And this is before I knew he was going to be the curator at the Hammer. I think it's even before he knew. So, but he did come over and we had a nice visit and that was that. And months passed by and then, you know, it came out that he was going to be curating it. And all of a sudden I got a call or an email rather from Connie Butler's assistant saying that she wanted to come now, and I just knew it was like, oh, Michael tipped her off to come, and then she was into it, and then the rest is that. But it felt like a little bit, the work was in a really, really good place at that time, at that visit, and Connie was into it, Michael was into it. So once the show went up, I think it did open up a lot of possibilities with just getting my work out there more, you know. I'm sorry, did I?
No. Yeah, that's a very relatively humble way of putting it, which I think is good.
Yeah.
But, I mean, to be a little more frank about it, to sort of push you off the ledge or whatever metaphor you want to use,
don't be scared.
Another way of putting it was a pretty significant career game changer, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, amount of eyeballs on it that I ordinarily wouldn't have had. Yeah, and it got some dealers from out of town interested, but it really did. I think these things are coming waves, and you know, like you get that little push. But you always are, you know, I guess like any artist, you're always looking for what the next one's going to be. And I feel like, yeah, it was kind of lightning in a bottle for at least a year or two there for sure. And I'm still like definitely still like enjoying the fumes from it, you know?
Right, right.
But yeah, you know, like anything though, like, you know, these things like have a afterglow that only lasts so long. So you got to like keep on it, you know?
Yeah. It seems like you have a healthy perspective on it.
You have to, because if you don't, you're going to rest on your laurels.
Where did you recognize? I mean, I think going through that, I imagine, would change your expectations quite a bit, you know, and among other things. And that would be where it would be hard to, I mean, you kept your job.
Yeah. I'm
you pretty much. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well,
practicality is key.
I mean, I was able to go part-time,
which
was like, you know, to me an enormous luxury I was pining for. So yeah.
So you were working pretty much 40 hours before?
I was working, roughly? Yeah, and then, you know, now I'm working about half that.
Oh, okay.
So, and the rest of the time I'm in the studio. And, you know, and I have to thank Made in LA at least partly for that push to have that happen. But there were other things, like I got a grant and you know, and I made enough money off the work to like, you know, whatever. I basically scrolled enough nuts in the tree so I could do this for a while. But I'm not, like I said, I'm very like, I've been in the art world long enough to know, like, you know, these things don't always last. So, right. You know, I'm always like very like circumspect about like, oh, like, yes, that show changed my life. And
right.
It's just all, champagne and shrimp from here on out. You know?
Is there an anxiety that comes along with a certain level of external validation for you? And I ask this because I've definitely talked to friends who, you know, were at one point in the Venice Biennale or other things that had that. This is a seminal kind of career changing, all of a sudden it's lightning in a bottle. And one of them described it to me as this feeling of like, it's so much more pressure now that I have the A to feel like I have to keep that than it was when I was like, you know, working up from behind, you know, when I could perceive myself as as an underdog. Do you feel that at all? Have you been able to kind of?
Well, I think this is the thing. This is why I kept my job, because right. I knew that if I, you know, did a radical thing by just like, I don't need a job now. I'm just going to be an artist.
Right.
I would be put into that position again, maintaining what I had accomplished and so on. And I kind of learned through mistake early on in my career by not like just, you know, throwing all my marbles into the studio practice and then, oops, I said it.
Thank you.
You know, like demanding that it work out.
Right.
Actually having worked at a gallery and seeing how other artists manage their careers for better or worse has also been instructive in that, like, cause some people put a lot of, unfair demands on their dealers to, basically carry them through all the time. And right. They only have so much power.
Right. Yeah, I kept wondering, by the way, just to interject, that when you said a couple of times, I've been in the art world and seen enough things, like how much of that is from what you've observed working at the gallery?
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, working at the gallery was, I ended up there by accident, really, because I just needed a job at the time. And I didn't think I was going to end up there as long as I have. But, you know, it really did teach me what, not only from a dealer's perspective, mm-hmm. like the kind of pressures that they face, but also how not to internalize and take things personally when, you know, they may not favor you over someone else, or they may not be helping as much as you think they should be, and so on and so forth. Like, there's all these, like, sort of like contingencies that, you know, they're almost out of everyone's control a lot of the time. And so, you know, like with every success that I've had, I've always kind of been a little almost to a fault. Like I'm not very good at like feeling it. Like,
right.
You know, when people are like, oh my God, are you so happy? I'm like, yeah, it's cool.
right.
You know, it's always a bit like maybe, you know, unhealthily numb towards it, but I don't know. It's my way of just like being like, all right, that's cool.
So there was never a moment where you wore the the prom crown or anything like that?
It felt like that. I mean, it's like some days you do, you know, and some days you want to be treated like a diva, and sometimes, you know, you're like, no, I would never be that. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I'm human. Mm-hmm. But but yeah, like I feel like having worked in the inside of the art world, it was a very sobering experience. And I would encourage actually a lot of artists to do that.
In some capacity
or another. I mean, I know a lot of artists already do that, like as installers and things like that. But as just from an educational point of view, I've noticed that even artists who have been, you know, showing for many, many years have never once worked for a gallery, never once art handled or anything. And they do have a weirdly some do. I'm not saying many or all, but, you know, an unhealthy expectation of what should happen, what. You know?
Yeah, I feel like I don't want to bore you or make you bore yourself, but I feel like it would be really interesting to dig a little into some of those details. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know, you know, you may feel uncomfortable mentioning particular examples, even if you don't mention them by name, but the place I go to first are like the people who are really pains in the asses, who are, you know, really entitled, and that's probably a little completely obvious, but what are some examples of people's, you know, expectations, the way that they interact, you know what I mean, that maybe is not like completely over the top, but clearly problematic?
I've noticed like there's some cases where, you know, you have artists who have require a lot of fabrication cost.
Mm.
And then even if you do make the money back, you still have to, there's still like the fabrication costs to take care of. And so there's like sometimes an inflated sense of how much money you actually made.
Right.
And then it's unsustainable because you're requiring an immense amount of money to actually make more objects. So I've noticed that get some people into trouble, you know, but you know, I've noticed though, these types of artists, they're very good survivors. They like always figure it out one way or another, but that's not the life for me personally.
Right.
Like I could not have that hang over my head all the time. You know, like, of course, like, you know, I'm knock on wood, but I would never want to make like, you know, huge $50,000 bronze sculptures, you know, that cost that $50,000 just to make.
Yeah.
You know, I can't live with that hanging over my head. So that's one kind of thing.
And what is, if you're allowed to say, what is your gallery's policy as far as fabrication? I mean, is it implicit that it's going to be fronted, or is it all going to be on the back end?
It's never implied. I mean, I've seen my boss fronted as a courtesy, but
never again.
maybe he will again. I don't know, but uh-huh. I've seen him do it sometimes, but most of the time he's been, no, I can't, I just can't. It's not a shrewd business decision to make. So yeah, there's one, I mean, I'm sure you've come across this issue before yourself.
Yeah, Deb, we don't mean to leave you out of the picture. Sorry.
No. I mean, I definitely have. I was just thinking in my head, that I do work with a number of artists who have had various experiences mm-hmm. working at galleries. I work with a number who haven't as well. But it is interesting to kind of see how people's expectations shift and change just depending on their experience. And depending on, you know, there also isn't really an industry standard for galleries. What galleries can offer and what they can't often depends on how they're doing that year or that month or where they're at in their career arc.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things that I think makes it tough for artists and gallerists to figure out, because so often there isn't a policy. You know, you can't necessarily have a policy that says
there's no like book,
right? You know, you may have a consignment agreement or contract of some kind that lays out mm-hmm. the most basic details. Mm-hmm. But so often it has to be on a case by case basis, which, you know, is interesting to navigate.
It's very holistic, and it's like a weird marriage actually.
Yeah.
And you know, it's ultimately between the artist and the dealer, what is the most like ethical thing to do, but you're also dealing with two people with their own psychological constellation of issues and, you know, and expectations of each other. And, you know, that stuff can get messy sometimes. And I've seen it get messy, and that's made me a much more kind of aware artist.
Yeah. Communication is key.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting because I don't know if you guys saw the article talking about unprofessionalism versus professionalism, right? And I've been thinking about that a lot in terms of LA as a whole, not specific artists or specific galleries or specific, but that idea of all of a sudden the city itself being in this position where we're now getting so much more attention, so many more, at least ostensibly, so many more resources. A lot of the museums are trying to expand, more galleries,
right?
More of all of these things. And I feel like part of what has attracted so many of us to being a part of LA was the fact that it wasn't New York, in terms of the kind of explicit expectations of a kind of professionalism. And so I guess the other question that I had for you sort of after Made in LA and all of those things, did you feel any pressure to shift the way you were approaching your work because of that attention?
Right. You know, there was like a bump in market interest.
Right.
Which was, you know, great thing. But it wasn't so intense where I felt like anything had to be overhauled. Like, I've seen artists get very successful very, very quickly and all of a sudden have teams of assistants working for them.
Right.
I never had that problem.
Yeah.
So, you know, because I've always relatively stayed small, you know, it's that was never much of an issue. Like, my main focus is always like, all right, well, how do I keep making work that's interesting, and how do I not be bored as shit making it? Like, how do I keep this interesting for me too? So that was like always stayed the main problem. I mean, it could that all you you're I could end up having had to overhaul a lot more than that.
Right.
If like all of a sudden I was making like 200,000, 300,000 a year and going crazy like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I've always like been like a slow burner, slow and steady. So, and I would never want to be an overnight success. I don't even know if there is such a thing.
Right. Well, you were just a moment ago though, alluding to, and this, I'm sure, you know, we all come across this phenomenon from time to time of the big success that starts hiring assistants. And the thing, the question that came to mind is when you were thinking about those, when you think about those people now, as if, you know, if they're still maintaining that level of production.
I don't know. I mean, it's a lot of them are. I mean, some aren't. I don't know. I mean, that no one ever talks about this, even behind closed doors, as far as I know. I'm not much of the hugest gossip person. You only can really rely on appearances, you know, like what you've heard, what you think you've seen. Or but yeah, I mean, if you look at any art forum from like, you know, 10 years ago, probably more than a third of them you've never heard of in the ads. And
you're talking about a very sort of scientific research type of approach. Right. I'm just talking about, like, you know, the people that you remember, you know, taking on those assistants if they're still in that situation.
It fluctuates. Like, I remember, like, one prominent artist, like, had, like, you know, and he's still doing quite well, but, like, the crash happened, I think, what was it, 2008, 2009? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, he was back down to, so he went from 10 assistants down to 2 again. Or something like that, you know. It happens, you know. And then he'll probably be back. He's probably backed up to 15 again. Who knows? Now, so
that sounds a little bit like, but I'm pretty sure it's not, because I don't think he had 10 ever. But he did have like 6 at one point.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't thinking of him specifically, but yeah, I mean, he could be. He's a cipher for any number of people.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, right. The generic Los Angeles success story: 10 assistants down to 2. Right.
Yeah, yeah. you know, and, you know, my mother had a company, I think at one point at her height, she had like 100 people working for her. By the end, I remember before she closed her company, she had like, you know, she had 2.
Right.
What kind of company did your mom have?
Oh, she ran a photo agency for commercial photography. So like, you guys have heard of Herb Ritz?
Yeah.
Yeah. So she like he basically is one of her biggest photographers. So she produced photo shoots for people like that. So at her height of her ambition, you know, she had an office here, an office in New York and all that.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, you know, for one reason or another, you're like back down to where you started.
Yeah. But the thing that comes to mind though is though the online stock photos that would have really killed that.
Oh yeah, you're right. You're totally right. Yeah, good stock photo history knowledge. Yeah. Industry knowledge there. Yeah. It was around that time. Yeah, like she right. was. She came up at a time when that wasn't really a thing.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah,
killed her. Yeah. But you know, I mean, there are people that adapt. You know, I mean, I guess, or maybe there is no adapting sometimes. Like, you know, I'm a little bit in awe of someone like, say, like Alex Katz, who I love. I love his work, but like, it's amazing that he's kind of stuck to this sort of almost monolithic style for whatever, 4 or 5 decades now.
Mm-hmm.
And hasn't really changed a whole lot, I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
But he still has been, it's almost like, he's, what do you call it, too big to fail or something like that.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. When you become sort of blue chip with a capital B, you know, you kind of are too big to fail, I think.
Yeah, but...
I think we're talking about younger people who aren't really quite...
Yeah, you know, yeah, we are. But yeah. There is that sense of, like, adaptability, like, you know, that, you know, I guess even in a short-term scope, like, seems, like, scary sometimes, like, you know... If all of a sudden you're down to one assistant and it's just two.
Do you think it says a lot about somebody if they, when they think about an artist who has gotten really big and then has come down and has to either adapt or not adapt, mm-hmm. that we kind of want them to really come down, you know? Do you think that Schadenfreude says a lot about the person, you know, perceiving that person's success?
Mm.
Because in other words, I mean, the subtext of all of this is, you know, yes, I want that. There's part of me that's kind of satisfied when that person comes down to earth.
Yeah, I mean, I think we do have like a base side of ourselves that like to see other people fail. Or get humiliated, because I think the word humiliate what's the other word, like when you're modest,
humility.
Yes, it's like I think that has some root in like dirt, earth. You know, like
right.
You want to see them being brought down,
right?
To the most sort of organic level of who we are as human beings. There's something like satisfying about it. And I think that at its worst side, it's like when we see like a celebrity get humiliated in public, or, you know, something like that, or an artist like have a flop or whatever like that.
Right.
So there is like some kind of like satisfaction in that, you know.
You're looking at me. Humiliation makes me sad. I'm such a softy on the inside.
Well, I think humiliation is misrepresenting what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Because I'm actually talking about kind of people who are, you know, moving their elbows around and kind of hitting everybody. I'm talking more about that kind of phenomenon.
Well, and I think the desire for people like that to come back to earth may have more to do or be more of a reflection of our discomfort with the extremity of the situation that puts them there. You know, so it's often kind of a feeling of grossness about a market that will propel somebody so quickly without necessarily having it correlate to anything other than the market itself.
Mm.
At least for me.
Okay. You know, so. Right. Okay. We're maybe not on exactly.
I mean,
the
some
same
people just
there,
get,
that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, but some people just get carried away on the winds of the market without really having any say in it. That can be sort of, you know, it's not even really up to the artist some of the time.
That's something that's so easy to lose sight of, I think. Because
we forget, like, it's, you know, they created themselves in their career, but, you know, there's a whole other eyeballs and money being brought into it that, you know, it's not like they said, hey, you buy this. All of a sudden there was a weird consensus occurred, a bubble, as it were.
Exactly. And then, yeah.
That happens.
Right. Are you good, Deb?
I'm good.
Yeah. Max, thank you so much.
Yeah, yeah. Great. Thank you, guys.
Deb, thank you.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Yay.
And?
We're out.
Excellent. Thank you so much again to Max for being such a great guest. And thanks to Deb Cloud and Mann for co-hosting again. And thank you very much for being here and listening. Before you go away, I do want to remind those of you who have supported the show that you can go check your email and you will be hooked up with the bonus segment of an extra half hour with Max, an extra great segment. And by the way, if I have not included you on that list and you feel that you, or you know that you have supported the show, just let me know. Just send me an email via the website or the conversationartpodcast@gmail.com and let me know. I did my best to get everybody on the list, but I may have left a couple of people out and I did not include people on the Kickstarter, which is about 3 years old now. So if you are still listening to this show and were part of the Kickstarter and are not on the list, let me know and I will add you as well because I do want you to hear this if that's what you want to do. Wanted to remind you, speaking of support, that this is a listener-supported show. Now that we've gone to once a week, we're talking about 20-plus hours that go into this show and more because Christopher Ford has been helping me out as an intern of sorts, and I want to thank him for his help for the last month or so. He will be continuing to help as well, particularly with social media, but miscellaneous other things along the way. And so he's putting in time as well. So we want to get to the point where we can, you know, maybe pay our helpers, pay me, and so on. So let me just mention a few names. I haven't done this in a while. Just got a donation from Adrian Paulus. Got a nice donation from Armando Belmas. Brian Ida has been a consistent supporter. David Rufo has been a consistent supporter and also a big mentioner on Facebook. Christine Frerix, Christina Weaver, who is a recent MFA grad who put out the minimum 10 bucks, but basically she explained it as, I gave up 2 lattes for some great art talk, and I encourage you, if you have not donated yet, to do the same, and you can get access to this great additional footage. Renee Bangerter gave a very generous donation. Tessa O'Brien, Katie Herzog, for the second time, K-Day, donated the show. Of course, Sarah Kane, a recent guest, gave a very generous donation. Catherine Sandoz gave it, and Jeffrey Morris donated again. So these are some recent donators. I want to thank them very much. I hope you guys enjoy the bonus footage. And those of you who would like to support, now is the time. Thank you very much in advance. Thank you for being here. If you would like to support the show otherwise, I would be more than grateful if you spread the word. Help us go places, help more people find the show. And, of course, social media via the various outlets that are listed on the website. TheConversationPod.com is where you go for that. Thank you guys so much for being here. Thank you for listening. Hope you get to hear the bonus episode and let us know what you think of that. I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.